Hello and welcome to the MisesUK.org podcast, sponsored by Finlingo.com. Tonight on show 18, I'm going to be speaking to the splendidly named Duncan Whitmore, who's the recent winner of our Mises UK essay competition. He also spoke at our recent Mises UK conference here in lovely old England, where his speech was extremely well received. Good evening, Duncan.
Good evening, Andy.
Now, before we get going, I just thought it might be useful if you could tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yes, I suppose I should tell you how I came to the Austrian school, really. I've always been sort of oriented towards the free market. I've never been a leftist or anything like that. But
oh, good man.
Yes, but probably originally more of your economist reading, Financial Times reading kind of free marketeer rather than sort of pure Misesian, so to speak. But I came to the Austrian school in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. The official explanations of that crisis just didn't seem to stack up to me. And then I found the Mises Institute and it all went from there, really. So that was 10 years ago this year. So I've been studying quietly and patiently since then. And it's culminated in this recent contact with Mises UK.
Yeah, I think a lot of us have a similar story, don't we? I think I was a hardline communist, I think. And then I read Human Action one day and suddenly it all fell into place. And it was like scales from the eyes of Saul, and I became Saint Paul.
It's interesting which different backgrounds people come to the Austrian school from. Actually, it's because some people are already sort of straight there, other people were almost the complete opposite, and then suddenly come over. So it is interesting to hear different people's backgrounds.
Yeah, it's funny as well, isn't it? Reading the Financial Times and the Economist now. I mean, it's like reading communist rags, isn't it?
Oh God, yes. I was a long time subscriber to the Economist, and I used to think I was probably really smug, you know, carrying it under my arm into the office, you know, and think that I knew everything. I was called quoting from it and all of that, whereas now I can't even bear to open it.
Yeah. I used to proudly carry the Guardian newspaper, yeah, to my eternal shame. What do you do for a living then? How do you get through each day?
Well, from up until November, I was working full time in the finance department of a large retailer, but I decided to give that up in November of last year and to try and go it alone, I suppose, as either as a full-time freelance writer or researcher, or as I also manage a small private investment fund. So I'm hoping that one of those two careers will work out. And obviously, if I end up on the street with a begging bowl, you know that they haven't. But that's what I'm. That's what I'm doing at the moment. So early days at the moment, but
I feel the same way about a software project I'm working on. Now we can talk about that stuff at the end, where you can plug yourself and give us some links and so on. But let's get down to business. The winning essay you wrote, it was on the subject of oil wars, mm-hmm. but we did speak about that last week with Tom Rogers. So I thought we'd concentrate instead on the speech you gave, which was on economic progress and centralisation. Why did you? Oh, and don't answer this as Keir Martland told me. Why did you speak about this topic?
Well, originally Keir did invite me to speak about oil wars, but
all right, okay.
I felt that I said everything I wanted to on that subject in the essay, so rather than just read out what I'd already written, I thought I'd do something different. And And thematically in the programme, Keir did say they wanted some more economics, and particularly something that was perhaps related to Mr. Dobson's previous preceding speech on the British economy. So I decided to go with that. It tied together a lot of different themes. So it was economics, but also the decentralising theme, which I think Mises UK is very much into, if you see what I mean. So it just seemed to be the most suitable topic, I think.
Yeah, it was very, very good. I think very, very well received. I think even, I can't speak for the great man, but I think Hopper liked it as well, particularly.
Thank you.
Now, when I was listening to the first part about economic progress and so on, you did outline a few things that make an economy grow. So we need more and more capital goods. That comes from higher investment. That's fed by lower taxes, less state regulation, and a certainty of law so that you can invest for the long term, knowing it's not going to be stolen from you in the future.
Yeah.
Now, all of those things seem obvious to us, anyone who's read Human Action and understood it. But why is it not obvious to many, many other people who you and I both meet, such as politicians, other people in your economics department, and what we might call the intellectual class? Why don't they understand these basic economic principles?
I think when you're talking about sort of your average Joe, trying to follow a long chain of reasoning is not necessarily always going to be what they're either able or want to do. They often only see things. I mean, this is true also, I think, of people in the mainstream economics profession or even mainstream intellectuals. Perhaps the sort of people that Nicholas Taleb might call the intellectual yet idiot, if you see what I mean. People who can only think in sort of first order logic, and they don't necessarily follow it all the way down. Or to just go back to what Henry Hazlitt said, the people who only see the most immediate consequences of a specific action rather than the full chain and thinking it all through to how it impacts on everybody. And of course, different people's time horizons as well. I mean, when you think that also many economists are in the pay of, say, like central banks or whatever, what are their paymasters, what are their preoccupations, and what are their what are they aiming for, and politicians who are in power, they're only really concentrating on, well, what's the next 5 years going to do for me, or what's going to get me re-elected. I find it very difficult to believe that these people are always ignorant of the consequences of their actions. But I think a lot of the time they might well choose to do the opposite anyway, because it's of a better advantage to them in the short to medium term.
Yeah, and that's why we see the growth of the state, of course, and the intellectual hangers-on. Now, we might come back to that later, but you also spoke a lot about a need for hard money and getting rid of this backdoor tax of monetary inflation.
Yeah.
It was a great blessing, I think, that Tony Blair didn't manage to finagle us into the euro.
Yes.
Now, do you think we should try to strengthen the pound now, or should we just abandon all these fiat monies and go for something else?
Well, it would be nice to abandon fiat money and go for something else, but how that's going to come about is a very difficult question. I mean, it's extremely difficult to wean people off the existing currency that they're used to. And this is one of the arguments that we might use against caution us into thinking that cryptocurrencies are going to be the next best thing, is that it's very, very difficult to get people off the currency that they're used to. And we saw that even in, you know, the German hyperinflation in the 1920s. They were still wheeling it out in wheelbarrows, even when it was practically worthless. And so it might well take the complete destruction of the currency before an alternative comes about. So perhaps a rather bleak prediction, but I mean, either the currency stabilizes or it goes to nil, and we move to a hard currency that way. But I don't think people are going to volunteer. I think it's going to be very difficult for people just to voluntarily move on to something else overnight, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, most people are just trying to get through each day, aren't they? So
exactly.
Monetary reforms are probably a long way down on most people's lists of things to do. But I'm going to make you president of the world for a second. I do a thought experiment. If you could, I know it's anti-Austrian, impose a currency on all of us, you sound it to me more like a gold or a silver man, or would you prefer to go for one of these cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin?
I think the better thing to do would be to actually abolish all legal tender laws and to see which money results or which people money want to use. I mean, I know you're trying to put me in the position of being a world leader and imposing on everybody else what I would like, but I think that would be the best thing, is to see which money people would want to go for if legal tender laws didn't compel them to use certain monies.
Yeah, I fell into my own trap there, didn't I, by trying to use force to do something good, which is always the bad thing to do.
Yes.
Moving on in the speech, you moved on to Brexit, and Brexit could free Britain from the evil clutches of the dastardly EU. But we've got this idiot in charge at the moment, Theresa May, and she seems to be doing everything she can to keep her husband happy and keep us inside this appalling bureaucratic nightmare. What do you think we can do to, at a kind of global or even a personal level to ensure that we do get a real Brexit?
I think it's a very odd situation that we find ourselves in. That the people negotiating with our withdrawal are people who really want to keep us in. And I find Mrs. May to be a complete enigma, actually. I think she's very difficult to read and quite difficult to tell what she really wants some of the time. She's very good at keeping shtum in some ways. I think the best scenario is for us to withdraw completely without any kind of deal and to make a unilateral declaration of free trade. So, I mean, because even Brexiteers like, say, Nigel Farage, for instance, they always go on about the deals. The deals are exactly what we want to avoid, in my opinion. So, in my view, I'm not really too concerned if all of these negotiations that are happening at the moment fail for whatever reason, if we do end up pulling out without a deal. But how we actually try and persuade people that that's a good thing, I think that's the tricky part. Because I think people still think that these trade agreements or trade deals, these are necessary things. And I don't really know how we would persuade people that that is a good thing.
Yeah, a free trade deal that takes 1,200 pages of text rather than just one piece of paper.
Well, exactly.
One piece of paper saying there's no restrictions, that's it.
Yeah, you can sum up free trade in a sentence. You don't need a trade deal. And it's always better to do it unilaterally anyway. Because whenever governments get involved with each other, they will always try to, well, even if they didn't try to restrict it, or even if they did have honourable intentions, then whenever you put governments or honourable governments into the situation of doing something, you have to bear in mind, well, what's going to happen when the boot is on the other foot and that you've got a malevolent government that's in charge or malevolent governments talking to you, then you don't want them to have already had that precedent of cooperating and talking to each other. You'd rather just keep them apart, leave us alone to do what we want to do rather than having some sort of apparatus to meddle with our lives more than they already do.
Yeah, it's this John Humphreys effect, isn't it, on BBC Radio 4 on the Today programme. What is the government going to do about this? Now, getting back to economics, there is one man in British government who does seem to understand economics. Or he's not even in the government, but he's in Parliament. And that's William the Rees-Mogster. Mm-hmm. Now, in the last few weeks, he's being seen more and more and more in newspapers and so on. But he's said to be too posh and too rich to have Joe Bloggs in the street supporting him. Now, it's my fervent wish that somehow he can boot out Theresa May and get in. Do you think he could do it and get rid of May, or is he just never going to make it?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that his advantage, Jacob Rees-Mogg, is that he comes across as authentic. And even though he's posh, I think he's decidedly not a snob or not an arrogant toff or anything like that. He's displayed wavering loyalty to obviously the Conservative government, and whether he genuinely means that or whether he's just being tactful, I'm not sure. I tend towards thinking actually that even though I think he would be a very good prime minister and a breath of fresh air from the current breed of politician that you have in Westminster, I still think that I think I'd prefer him as being an underdog. And I think that if he was to move from that position into being in a position of power, we actually might start hating him for possibly some of the compromises or some of the more difficult things he might have to do. Because at the moment, of course, when he's not in the government, he's on the back benches. He has more or less the luxury of saying whatever he likes. I think we might come to change our view of him if he was to be put in the position of being in the main government. So.
Yeah, the ring of power corrupted even Gandalf, didn't it, who refused to take it in Lord of the Rings. Okay, so I'm going to make you prognosticate again and look into a crystal ball. Where we are right now, it looks to me like we're really going to just kind of crawl along and still be in the EU without any voice or say at all. What's your opinion on that? Are we going to stay inside the hotel socialism, or are we able to actually get out?
Well, I think eventually the EU itself might collapse anyway, so perhaps we don't have too much to worry about. I think certainly the current political class are going to do everything they can to try and keep us in, even if it's keep us in de facto, even if we're nominally out of it. Even if we are out of it, there's no reason why they can't conclude agreements between Britain and the EU, which are more like, would be more or less the same as what we have at the moment when we're in. So my hope eventually, as I said, is that the whole thing will just collapse anyway. And it's looking rather precarious anyway. I mean, how its finances might stack up after Britain leaves is looking all the more difficult for them. And of course, Britain's not the only, I mean, Britain is the one that's taken the decisive step of having a referendum and voting to leave, but there's nationalist fervour amongst the rest of the bloc as well. I mean, perhaps in places like the Netherlands, even in France or Catalonia, as we've seen recently, the Flemish, I think. So I don't think Brexit is necessarily going to be the last word on the EU's future.
Yes, let's hope it collapses as soon as possible. Now, moving on to higher things, you spoke a bit too about that kind of Hayekian lattice of the interconnecting capital structure bound together by time and knowledge and so on. Mm-hmm. But the state still thinks it can micromanage everything, even though it's failed at everything it's ever done. How do you think we can spread this knowledge of Austrian economics and Mises and Rothbard to educate people about real economics?
I think good ideas tend to attract themselves. And I was quite impressed by one of the speeches, actually, we had at our conference by, I think it was Mr. George Pickering, who he's been to the Mises Institute in the US, and how they avoid all these, you know, gimmicky attempts to attract young people, like stupid things on Twitter or things like that. I think good ideas and the truth are very powerful things, particularly in times of crisis when people, the traditional explanations are not working, then people do seek sort of alternative explanations or explanations which make more sense than what they're already being told. How we go about disseminating that on a much wider basis is going to be very difficult. I think I have a skepticism as to whether although the internet is reducing the cost of information or getting hold of information, I still suspect that people really use the internet to confirm their already deeply entrenched beliefs rather than try to challenge their opinions. So what we might see is really a sort of growing of different extremities. So if radicalism, if you see what I mean. So we would be one of those, the Austrian school, but you'd also probably have hard leftism growing a lot stronger and as a counterweight as well, as people are able to get more their hands on more of information from that line of thought as well. So although it's much easier for us to give our message across these days, it's much easier for everybody else to do so as well. So I think that's going to be the challenge that we face is that sort of competition from other schools of thought, which think that they have the answer and can present it in an attractive and accessible way.
Yeah, I always like to believe in the human spirit, and I think the light of truth will eventually come through. I just mm-hmm. want it to be in my lifetime and not 200 years in the future.
Yes.
Now, one thing, the only point that I was concerned about in your speech was when you said we should localize taxes. Because I want to get rid of all taxes, just cut them all. Can you explain that idea a bit more for me?
Yes, well, if you localize revenue-raising authority, then that authority has much less power over its revenue-raising power is focused on a smaller group of people. So it therefore cannot be as onerous or as burdensome with its revenue raising power as an authority whose tax base is much wider, for example. So let's just say, for example, that if my revenue raising area was just Kent, for example, then I would only have the ability to take taxes from people who are in Kent. There aren't that many people in Kent as there are, say, in the whole of Britain anyway. So my tax revenue is going to be limited in that way, and my government spending is not going to be as high in absolute terms. But also, if I annoy or overburden the people of Kent with too high taxes compared to, say, nearby Sussex, Surrey, or Essex or London, it's much easier for those people to jump ship to one of those neighbouring counties and to leave me. And so if all my productive citizenry just leave because I burden them with too many taxes, then I won't be able to raise any revenue at all. So it's much more likely to keep taxes low or moderate at least than it is if you have a centralized taxing authority.
Yeah, I always love in history that my favourite part of the Holy Roman Empire was when Germany, there was hundreds of little Germanies and hundreds of little places. And to this day, we still have an echo of that in Switzerland, which it actually got out of the Holy Roman Empire, but it kept the structure of all these little tiny places.
Mm.
And it's a fantastic place. And I'm working on a plan now to get out of there. But over in Switzerland, you'll have different taxes in just different towns. You know, the next town along will have a totally different tax structure, which is great. Now, I just wanted to finish on one last thing. We could do Mises UK, we can do hundreds of other things, but the British people do seem, rather strangely to me, to be attached to terrible state schools and the appalling NHS and all these other crumbling bits of the welfare state. So how are we going to break this umbilical attachment that the British people feel to British government services?
Well, that is, if I do go back to a theme, in the theme of the essay again, the theme of decentralisation, which I think is the positive message that we can bring to spread liberty, which is that we're not attacking these things head on. We're not shouting from the rooftops that people need to abolish the NHS or we need to have school vouchers or abolish state schools or anything like that. All of those things, when you're trying to impose that from a central point, you're always going to end up being shouted down, especially on the NHS. I mean, there is no way that I don't think in the next, unless it collapses anyway, there is no way you're going to persuade people to abolish the NHS. It's as I said, I can't remember who it was who said that the NHS is the closest thing that the British have to a religion.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but if you emphasize, if you start to decentralize revenue raising and administrative authorities, then what you're telling people is that they can decide these things for themselves and they can go whichever way they want to. So it is true that while we'll still have socialized healthcare in most of the country, some of those, because the pressure that decentralization puts on revenue raising anyway and on regulation, as we just explained, then some of those authorities will have to try free market reforms and they'll have to privatize some of their healthcare or introduce reforms into their education. And those ones were the places that will start to flourish. And at the very least, even if all of them didn't, at least, you'd have reduced the socialist hellholes to possibly just a few places in the country rather than all of it. So that I think I feel quite strongly about, that the decentralization is the way to go to promoting liberty in the world today.
Fantastic. I like your thinking. Okay, Duncan, it was fantastic and tip-top to speak to you tonight, and thank you for explaining some more of your ideas, especially the one about the local taxes. Now, coming back to earlier on, do you have a website where we can find out how to hire you and hire your economic services?
I do, but I have agreed with Keir actually that any new content that I write, I'm going to offer to Mises UK first. So Mises UK is probably the place is the best place to find me from now on. So.
Fantastic, because we are looking for good content providers, and I'm sure you're going to give us lots of excellent content.
I hope to do so, yeah.
Okay, thank you, Duncan. Thank you for your time tonight.
Thank you very much, Andy.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's programme on the MisesUK.org podcast. If you'd like to help us out, please do us a favour for English Liberty and leave us a 5-star rating or review on iTunes, which can help us get more noticed in this attention-hungry world. Alternatively, you can help us out by going to our donate page at MisesUK.org and making a contribution, where I'm sure that our esteemed chairman, Mr. Keir Martland, will be happy to take your cash faster than a British state tax inspector can say, "Give me all of your money." We'll be back soon with episode 19 of the Mises UK podcast. In the meantime, please look after your property and freedom responsibly.